views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, good evening and welcome to this week's edition of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw, and I'm here with what I hope to be soon to arrive, my co-host, Roy Avila. And we're going to have an interesting show tonight on two aspects that are so critical to the future prospects of the United States, two elements that combine together to bring about the fast-approaching wildlands project implementation here in the United States. Our first hour, we're going to talk about the Endangered Species Act. That's really the core ingredient for bringing to us the grab of rural lands across the United States. And in the second hour, we're going to talk about conservation easements, which is the clever tool used to implement the wildlands project, particularly when it combines with the Endangered Species Act. Our first hour, our guest is going to be Margaret Byfield. Margaret is the executive director of Stewards of the Range, which is a national property rights organization that is behind the Hage versus the United States takings case. And for those who are regular listeners, you probably heard and have heard our replays of the two-hour interview we did with Wayne Hage on his landmark case that he is so far victorious in against the Department of Interior and the federal government for the takings of his water on his ranch in Nevada. Stewards of the Range is headquartered in Idaho with an office in Texas. Margaret is also vice president of Liberty Matters, which publishes the weekly Liberty Matters news service. And if you're not getting that, I heartily recommend that you do. You can go to check out Liberty Matters by Googling just that name, Liberty Matters, and you'll come up with it easily, and you can sign up for their weekly news service, which can be of great assistance to those who are focused and interested on these issues. And gee whiz, there's no reason why any and all Americans should not be. Margaret, are you with us yet? No, we don't have Margaret, so we're going to be with her shortly. But last week, the House passed a reauthorization of the 32-year-old Endangered Species Act. The ESA, as it is often called, has destroyed many lives, and its record of success for species protection is dismal indeed. Resources have been put out of reach of the marketplace, driving up the cost of living for all of us. The federal government's reauthorization will create permanent damage to the American experience. And we're going to hear from Margaret Byfield and from some other experts in this area later in the hour regarding the ongoing political maneuverings regarding Congressman Pombo's reauthorization bill. We're going to hear later in the hour from Julie Smithson and from Catherine Lehman regarding the nature and effect of the Endangered Species Act on America and Americans. The Endangered Species Act, of course, the big problem there is how it has put plants and animals above the interests of human beings and their property. And, of course, with the recent decision by the Supreme Court in Kelo, we now all know that private property is under assault from all branches of the federal government. And, of course, this has been ongoing for a long time, especially in rural areas of America, and nothing has been more responsible for that onslaught than the Endangered Species Act. So its reauthorization for another 30 years is really critical. So So welcome to tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. And while we continue to work through some issues to bring Margaret on the line, we'll take a call from Julie Smithson, who is going to join us tonight from Ohio. Julie is the director of Property Rights Research .org. If you check that out on the web, you'll find incredible volumes of information on property right issues and the assault upon property rights. And she's been very watchful of the endangered species process here with the new reauthorization bill. Julie, are you with us this evening?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Michael.
Well, it's good to hear from you. If you've, I think you've been on the line, so you heard the first few minutes of the show. We don't have Margaret on the line yet, but let's get the show started. And in a summary, what is it that the average American needs to know about the Endangered Species Act?
I think the most important thing that the average American should be aware of is that this act that has been on the books for 32 years, as with a lot of other federal legislation, makes extensive use of language deception. And by that I mean that a word like restoration or protection or even the word endangered or threatened maybe doesn't mean to the reader what the federal agency intends for it to be. So the very definition of an endangered species is a species that's endangered throughout all or part of its historic range. Now this means that, for example, the spotted owl in the Pacific Northwest, it may not be endangered anywhere within its entire historic range except one small area.
Well, it'd be like the Kit Fox in downtown Los Angeles.
Exactly. Or in my neighborhood here in West Central Ohio, it could be the Indiana bat. There's many species that have been used. I call them poster species because they seem to have the ability to wipe out an area of either development or resource extraction or resource providing very effectively just by the fact that they might have a problem with their habitat. Never mind that human beings have habitat and needs too.
Well, the Endangered Species Act has a strong record of putting plants and animals, is what I always say, putting plants and animals ahead of human beings when it comes to land resource issues. We now have Margaret, I think, on another line. Margaret, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, sorry we didn't get that worked out right at the beginning of the show. For our listeners, this is Margaret Byfield, and as we've explained, she's the Executive Director of Stewards of the Range and Vice President of Liberty Matters. And Margaret, you've been right there in the midst of what's been going on in Washington, D.C., working with people there and elsewhere around the country. And Julie's given us a brief introduction to what the Endangered Species Act is. And Julie, I think your characterization of how the Endangered Species Act and so many acts like it use words in ways that are not common to ordinary usage of people and even congressmen who are voting for this. And so that ends up meaning that we end up with all kinds of strange applications of how these laws become effected. And we had a show 3 weeks ago here on logical positivism, using the meaning of words and destroying the meaning of words so that the words can end up meaning anything. And the Endangered Species Act has certainly been a good example of how that's been the case. Tell us what's going on with the reauthorization of the ESA.
Well, the original draft version was changed, and there were some adjustments made to it, and it is now has passed the House of Representatives, although it was a close vote. It was 223 to 196 with 11 congressmen not voting. And I would say that's encouraging, the fact that it was a close vote. But now it goes to the Senate, and it can actually be rewritten or amended again before the Senate does a vote on it. They are actually, right now, I saw in the news today, they said it could be up to a year before it actually makes it to the Senate. But this is nebulous because it could be a week. It could be tomorrow. No one really knows. And the general public doesn't have access to the wording of the bill, a lot of the legislators don't. They are asked to vote on something that they know very little about, and it's almost impossible to expect your elected official to know the wording of all the things that they are required to vote on. That's where the citizen that's informed and educated and empowered can be a great asset to their elected official as well as to their community by learning what these bills are all about and the far-reaching effects they can have from Washington, D.C. to the furthest reaches of America.
Well, and certainly this bill has far-reaching effects. Now, the bill went through Congress lickety-split, did it not?
Yes, it did.
It was filed and passed, marked up and then passed through the House within 2 weeks. And the bill was not, nobody saw the bill until about, well, less than 24 hours before it was actually filed, and that was under lock and key, where they were given a copy to view it but couldn't take a copy with them. So, but I think, if you don't mind, I'd like to back up and give a little bit of political history on how this all came about, because it was almost a year ago, back in November, that Congressman Pombo informed a group of property rights advocates and resource users in Washington, D.C. at a meeting, which our attorney, Fred Grant, was in the meeting. And he explained that he was going to be pushing a reauthorization bill of the ESA, but that he could only accomplish small fixes. And so what the property rights advocates, landowners, were going to have to be quiet in this debate, because he really thought that we could foil the small fixes, which is all he thought he could get accomplished. Well, you know, property rights advocates and landowners don't take kindly to being told that our issues aren't important and our property rights aren't important. And so that really galvanized, I think, a lot of people in the movement. And by about March or April, a number of us have started coordinating, different organizations have started coordinating across the country, and were able to generate, get the word out to the grassroots, which was critically important to the debate. And a couple of the groups that we were working with in Washington, D.C., the American Policy Center and the National Center for Public Policy Research, did a great job at getting some very high-powered organizations in D.C. to sign on to a letter that actually, you know, explained that we don't want the ESA reauthorized. And that put a lot of political pressure, I think, on this whole debate. And I think what's really key for people to understand is that it was the property rights issues which are driving this debate. Pombo was set to file a bill, which I think everybody's pretty familiar with, which included invasive species and, of course, had no mention of property rights in it.
Let's just pause for a second and make sure the audience understands what you mean when you say invasive species. The Endangered Species Act was to include a section on invasive species.
Correct.
Explain that for a minute.
Well, that meant that species that might impact the critical habitat of another species. Well, let me give you an example. If there's a certain type of grass that wasn't native to the area.
A typical lawn grass, for instance.
Yes, ryegrass. Then they could require that be removed. It could become a violation of the law if, you know, Shasta daisies were determined to be an invasive species in an area because some bird didn't like it. And all of us who have, you know, flowers in our front yard could be violating the ESA. An invasive species is something that the environmentalists have been working very, very hard to get passed in Congress. I believe there was a bill put forth that was a singular intent. It's been attempted to be placed in the highway bill. You know, this is part of their long-term agenda to get invasive species. And so expanding the ESA's authority beyond, you know, the plants and animals are used to into invasive species with a huge expansion of the ESA, and this was something that Pombo was pushing. Now, there have been a lot of reports out that, oh, he didn't really intend for that bill to go forward, that it, you know, was a red herring, that he was going to do the right thing all along, and that one thing that I think is important to note, because I don't find that to be true at all, is his bill had already, the first bill had already been put through legislative council, which is usually the last step they take before they file it. Another thing is that when the handful of people were able to view the bill that he ended up dropping, the H.R. 3824, less than 24 hours before it was filed, they had informed us, some of us were on a conference call with the staff, and then there were a couple of people that were in the room, and they informed us that invasive species had been taken out of that bill. And R.J. Smith in D.C. Noted that there were still places in that draft where invasive species, the language was showing up, because I think it was in Palmer's original bill, I think 17 different times by my count. And so that Palmer had this new bill stashed away and just, you know, was going to file it at the appropriate time, I don't think is in a correct analysis. I think that maybe a couple weeks prior to the actual filing of this bill, they actually started getting serious about making some significant changes. And they had to in order to get their bill filed. And I think what is really important for landowners to understand is that the tone of the debate after the bill was filed was property rights driven. Now, I think there's really good reason to argue whether or not this bill protects property rights, and I would say it doesn't.
The whole idea, it strikes many people as being antithetical to property rights. I mean, we've had a drive in this country for many decades now that has just squeezed our timber owners, our ranchers, and our farmers. Many of them either right out of business or right to the brink of being out of business, and it's very disheartening. For many people to see the concept, the premise of the Endangered Species Act is that plants and animals under the control of the federal government are more important than the conduct of a person's life or the ideals behind private property. For those of us who understand what private property is, we know that the ecology and the prospects for a healthy landscape are existent only in a regime of private property and not with centralized government control.
You're absolutely right, and I'm not one of those that sees the environmental movement as a group of do-gooders. I think the intent of the Endangered Species Act was not to recover species, but was to extinguish private property, and that's the only thing that you can say that act has actually accomplished. And so, you know, that's a real hurdle. I think that's a real problem. You can't amend a bad bill. And so it is, but I think from a political perspective, I think it's important for landowners to realize that our message changed the debate. And, you know, the floor debate that surrounded the passage of H.R. 3824 was focused on private property. Now, whether or not the language actually accomplished that was another story. But I don't ever remember seeing, you know, congressmen stand up on the floor and defend private property like they did. I mean, that to me was amazing. Now, we have a long ways to go, but I do think it's really important to note that landowners have had a significant voice in this debate. And I think it's important that that continue.
Well, it certainly is, and certainly the call is out across the country that your house, your business are not safe, and landowners in rural areas have known that their lands have not been safe for a long time. And now it's everyone in America is beginning to feel that pressure, and so a turn is maybe ready to happen, but we can't let up the pressure because the dollars and the legislation and the political power behind the grab for political party property and for private property is greater than it's ever been in the history of the world, and it's going to take the average American standing up, working with others in their communities working with other communities to bring about a great change in this country so that the freedoms that we've been granted can be passed to our children. We'll be right back at Freedom 21. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. While some stations take a commercial break, we're going to continue with our conversation with Margaret Byfield and Julie Smithson. Julie, tell us, give us an example or two of the kinds of pain that the Endangered Species Act has brought about for people living in the lands of America.
Well, in my own community back in early 1999, it's a farming community comprised of a lot of Amish and Mennonite farmers, and there was a meeting held at a local Mennonite Bible college in the sanctuary. The meeting was hosted by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Until that meeting, I had no idea of the depth of a plan when a community comes under the crosshairs of a federal agency. We were handed relocation brochures at the door for us, and we were told that we would have to move because they discovered that we had possible habitat for the Indiana bat. I felt as though, for the first time in my life, I didn't understand English. I didn't understand, and no one else in that room except for the federal agency representatives understood what was being said there. And of course, that's quite a gutting moment to realize that everything that you hold dear is all of a sudden on the line. And that was what started me on this journey. Well, I've met many regulatory victims, and when I say regulatory, I'm just referring to the Endangered Species Act, but there's many others. These are people that have not been poor stewards. They've been really good stewards. They've taken good care of their land, their resources, plants, animals, wildlife, domestic life, just across the board. They've done nothing wrong. And this is one of the hard things to understand, is how an act can take people who are doing nothing wrong and remove them from everything they hold dear. And oft times, it's many generations of the same family, many generations of a community. It turns once thriving areas into ghost towns. And we've watched as the West burns millions of acres each year, and most of the acreage that is directly affected by these fires is mismanaged or non-managed. It's not private property. It's federally owned land that has been allowed to just sit there and build up a fuel load of dead brush or dead underbrush. I'm reminded often of the blowdown from 1995 that's in the Boundary Canoe National Wilderness along our U.S.-Canadian border in northern Minnesota. There are thousands and thousands of acres of full-grown trees that were blown down in a windstorm. Now, under private property rights, people would have gone in there and cleaned that up. Now, we have a tinderbox just waiting to burn, and they won't put it out because there's no way to get into it. These are major trees that have been blown down, and they're 10 or 20 feet off the ground. It's just an impenetrable maze. And that's federally owned land. I don't think I know of anyone that would have done that with privately owned land.
No, you have an interest in the future with private property. You have an interest in the next election if it's a government managed property. So, that's a good example, and certainly the experience that you had in Ohio has been replicated all over the country, from Klamath to right here in Santa Cruz. We've got a forest that is ready to burn. We're about ready to welcome back our audience here at Freedom 21. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw with our guests, Margaret Byfield of Stewards of the Range and Julie Smithson of PropertyRightsResearch.org. Margaret, tell us, before we get back to discussion on the Endangered Species Act, tell us a little bit about Stewards of the Range. And of course, we talk here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz regularly about the Wildlands Project, and we have Michael Kaufman is a regular guest on our show. Tell us about Taking Liberty and other activities at Stewards of the Range.
Well, Taking Liberty is a really important educational program that we were very fortunate to be a part of, and thank Michael for his help on that, for sure. Stewards is a property rights organization. I think you've probably also interviewed my dad along the way, Wayne Hage. We got our start supporting the Hage versus United States takings case. When that case was first filed, it was a pretty aggressive challenge. There really was a need to gather support for it, and that really was the catalyst for Stewards of the Range. Since then, we've gone on and have taken on other cases and have developed a number of things where we can help other landowners. Our focus really is to educate landowners to be better tooled, better prepared for these battles, so that if it does land on their doorstep, they know where to go and what they need to do to fight it. So we do some pretty aggressive training. We do hold a number of conferences. We have one coming up in Reno, October 28th, which is titled Property Rights After Kilo. That's going to be an important session because I think we have four attorneys coming in that are in the middle of these issues. They're in the courtroom fighting these issues. Michael Kaufman will be there. He's going to open the program. I think it's really important that we set the stage. The Taking Liberty program is a great kind of explanation of where we are in the battle. The Wildlands Project shows us where the environmentalists want to take us. Taking Liberty shows us how far they have come. It's a visual presentation on the web, and it'll show region by region how much land they have locked up, what programs are ongoing, and what they plan to lock up through these different programs. And as I'm sure you've looked at it pretty close, it's kind of eerie how the pattern of what they're locking up follows right along the lines of the Wildlands Project.
Well, you know, Michael put out a map 10 years ago from documents that he obtained in Geneva, and it is amazing how what has been locked up through Endangered Species Act protections and through conservation easements and through direct acquisitions by NGOs or by government itself, how that map is being formulated. And if you're not familiar with it, you can go to Stewards of the Range and look at this online. You can buy the DVDs at both Stewards of the Range and at freedom21santacruz.net. And it is a very valuable tool if you're at all focused on the defense of private property, or if you're a rural landowner, you need to know what the plan is so that you can recognize it when it comes into your community. And it's in your community because it's in every community across the country. There are sustainable development programs that are designed to help implement this map. And when the map is finalized and when the final hammer is brought down, America, not just for the rural residents, but for the urban residents, will not be the America that we think we live in. It will be totally different. We'll be confined to narrow settlement zones, and we'll be restricted in our mobility, and the great lands of America will be off limits to the American people. So it's critical that you understand what the Wildlands Project is all about, and there's no quicker, faster, and sharper way of learning about it than understanding the Wildlands Project and looking at the DVD video called Taking Liberty, produced by Stewards of the Range and Dr. Michael Kaufman, is just the perfect methodology for coming to understand that. I'm going to be there at the Reno conference, and I look forward to meeting you there, Margaret.
I look forward to it, too.
It ought to be a great conference. Now, we have a caller, Tim from Texas. Oh, we've lost Tim from Texas. Well, Tim, call us back, and we'll get you back on the line here. Julie?
Yes.
What do you see happening as a result of this reauthorization? Do you see it lessening the condition, the adverse condition for landowners and the concept of private property, or do you see it accelerating it?
Well, let's do this as an if it's reauthorized, because we still have the option of repeal.
And that's the option that that makes the most sense to many people in the freedom movement.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. Julie, before our commercial break came up, you mentioned the word repeal, and that's something that citizens have been afraid to say for many years about the Endangered Species Act. But repeal does solve these problems. I mean, it doesn't mean that we can't pass a law that says nobody's to shoot or kill a bald eagle or some other valued creature that is short in numbers. But the idea behind the Endangered Species Act, really born out of the international treaties, is not about protecting species. As Margaret said, it's a lot more about the taking of private property. So, what are your thoughts about repeal, and how is it that practically that can come about here over the next period of time?
I think through education of a lot more people and elected officials as to the perks, if you will, of repeal. The fact that we have already come 32 years since the original Endangered Species Act, and actually there was another 5 or 6 years before that where there were other versions of the act in place, that we can do right by species without this legislation. One thing that kind of troubles me is that the definitions within the Act as it stands right now give the Secretary even more powers than she already has. And Gail Norton is not an elected official. She's an appointed official. as was Bruce Babbitt and other people that were secretaries of the Department of Interior.
And their job is to get more land for the federal government. Certainly, Gail Norton, advertised as a libertarian, is no friend of the rancher, farmer, or timber landowner.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that's in the bill as it stands right now under Section 4 is the determination of endangered species and threatened species. And it refers to the fact that the secretary will now have the power to determine whether any species is an endangered or threatened species because of the following factors. And this is important. The present or threatened destruction, modification, or curtailment of its habitat or range by human activities, competition from other species, drought, fire, or other catastrophic natural causes. I believe that at any point in time, the secretary could determine that one of those things is occurring anywhere in the country.
Well, droughts happen, and droughts are natural, and if a species can't endure a natural drought, to use that as the excuse to take people off the landscape and confiscate their land is an abominable idea.
And that's the first of five things in that determination.
And that's within the new reauthorized endangered species.
Exactly. Now, my website at propertyrightsresearch.org, there are buttons for different things that are of importance to your listener. One of them is there is an Endangered Species Act button. There's another button for legislation. There is another button that's very extensive on the Wildlands Project. So if someone wants to just bone up on different parts of the property rights issues, they can do that. There's over 14,000 pages there that I've researched very carefully, and as you said, there's an amazing amount of information there. And it's done so that no one else will have to go through what we did. But one thing that was wonderful about our experience was it taught us about networking. And after 3.5 years, we watched U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officially close its proposal to turn us into a federal wildlife refuge. We have our Amish and Mennonite farmers out here. We have wonderful neighbors, and we do not have a federal wildlife refuge. And strangely enough, we still have possible habitat for the Indiana bat.
Well, you know, that just shows people around the country that by organizing, by building off the successes that are out there, we talk about successes on this show regularly. There are plenty of successes. Your community can be a success, too. You just need to follow some of the examples, be creative yourself, and work with your neighbors, work with other communities, and we can beat this beast back. And for those communities that have not yet circulated the Sustainable Development Guide prepared and produced by Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, let me suggest you go to our website, freedom21santacruz.net, and look at our electronic version, and do like so many communities have done, order these things in bulk, so that you can distribute it to your neighbors and associates and to your political officials. It's called Understanding Sustainable Development, Agenda 21, a Guide for Public Officials. And in it, you'll learn what sustainable development is, how it's being implemented, and what you can do. And I certainly do recommend to the listeners who want to understand what's going on and become involved and protect your own lives and property and the lives of your children's and our posterities generally to go into Julie Smithson's website propertyrightsresearch.org and there's a wealth of information you'll be all the better for doing it. And I want to thank you so much, Julie, for all the work you've done for so many years and for being with us tonight and sharing some of those experiences.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for all the things that you do, because you work as hard as any of the rest of us, and you're owed a great debt for that.
Well, the movement is rising, and I think what Margaret is telling us, that people in Congress, maybe for the first time, impartially from the repercussions of the Kelo case, are beginning to take notice that Americans do care about private property, and that we can't be fooled forever about the protection of a red-legged frog or a long-toed salamander or a fly or all the other things that are being served by the Endangered Species Act, while the American experience gets burned right down to the crisp of a burnt-out forest. American people aren't going to be happy with that result, and I think more and more people are taking the precautionary tale of of fighting against it so that that isn't our fate. You know, when the American experience resurrects, it will be grand indeed, because so many tools are available to us today that weren't available to our ancestors. And if we reincorporate those ideals of freedom, we'll march to great heights. We have Tim on the line from Texas. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Have you got a comment or a question for our guest tonight?
Is Margaret there?
Yes, she is.
Margaret, you're in Taylor?
Yes, I am.
Are you part of Michael McCall's new district?
No. We're Carter.
The new congressman, I kind of figured he would have been in your district. He's around the Austin area. I got changed from Ron Paul's district to Michael McCall's district, and I got the opportunity to speak about Agenda 21 for about 5 minutes at a Texas Farm Bureau convention last year. And Michael, you'll be proud to know that I stuck one of these guides for public officials right under his nose. I thought I was going to have to chase him down to give it to him after I got through speaking about Agenda 21 in front of the farmers. They don't seem to understand that their own government will steal their property. It's going on at a massive rate. I'm in Red Rock, Margaret, so I'm just right down the street from you. A friend emailed me this about this broadcast tonight is the only reason I know about it. I'm affiliated with another broadcast called American Exposé, and it is Chris Gerner's AmericanExposé.com, and that's American spelled with a K, not a C, AmericanExposé.com, and it has mountains of information about Agenda 21 and just all kinds of good stuff.
Well, Chris Gerner does have a very good site, and he has a good radio show. I know he had interviewed Gary Robinson, our guest from last week, and he's got a good radio show as well. The word about Agenda 21, sustainable development, is spreading, and when it catches that critical mass, congressmen are going to run for cover, hoping and pretending
that they can
cover up.
Yeah, Michael McCall's already running for cover, because he was running for me because I had to literally chase him down to give him this, because I was handing them out at the door as the farmers were leaving. I passed out about 150 of them that night.
Well, good for you. I know we've had a lot of response to the guide from Texas, and you know, I was on the Power Hour yesterday morning with Dave Van Kleist, and had callers from around the country saying they're using this guide and how wonderful and helpful it has been in their own communities for fighting off these kinds of dynamics.
I went to a print shop and printed up 150 of them and gave just almost every one of them out that night, Michael. So.
Go to a print shop, but you know, we can send these in bulk at a pretty reasonable price, less than what you're shopping for at the local Kinko's.
I'll definitely be in touch with you on that. In fact, I have a piece of legislation that I drew up, and Margaret, did you say that you were Wayne Hage's daughter?
That's correct.
I think we've probably got some mutual friends that I'm sure you know. G.B. Oliver?
Yes, I know G.B.
Do you know Jay Wally?
Yes, I know Jay Wally.
Jay Wally is a real good friend of mine, and he was going to be the first guest I had on my radio show when I had my radio show that I had to quit because of my health. But Jay Wally named me Timothy Revere. And I have come out with a piece of legislation called the Revere Act, and it simply states that there can be no endangered species. They are already cloning dogs and cats on the open market for anybody that wants them cloned. So species cannot go extinct any longer, period, because they can all be cloned.
Well, it's certainly the case that that Americans are not wise if we allow the theft of our neighbor's property in order to pretend that we're protecting species. I want to thank you for calling very much, Tim.
Hey, thanks for a lot for the time, and I'll be in touch with you, Michael.
Great.
And Margaret, God bless you.
Thank you
for your work, man.
Thank you.
You know, the reference to Wayne Hage, I must say, Margaret, your father's interview with us continues probably to be the most popular on our archives. You can hear the interview, a two-hour interview with Wayne Hage at freedom21santacruz.net/radio, and you can order CDs of that tape. It was a brilliant insight and an expose of how private property law works, and of course what the Hage case that the Court of Claims has done has shown that how it is that by tracing your title back to its origins, you can protect yourself against not all, but many of the attacks that are currently being made by government on property owners. So for those people who feel like they're under attack, I would really recommend that they attend the conference in Reno put on by Stewards of the Range this October 28th, isn't it?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, tell us, has the ESA made a mess rural landscapes across America?
Well, definitely. One of the maps that Michael Kaufman did for us in the Taking Liberty program is showing species by county. And it's a very powerful map. He did not show every species that is listed. I can't remember the number that he showed. It's a very minimal number. And every county in the country is covered, affected in some way by an endangered species.
Every county in the country, huh?
Yeah. So the command and control, is there. The potential to affect every homeowner is there. And, they play the divide and conquer game, and I think they do go after communities and individuals that are vulnerable. They tend to back off of those that will put up a fight, like Julie's story tells, which is a great story, one of our the movement's great victories. And so it's the command and control that can happen under the ESA is very scary. And I think one thing to remember as people assess the Pombo Bill is all that is still there. I mean, this is a reauthorization of that law, and that needs to be considered. One of the other things that I'd like to point out about the bill, there's been a lot of talk about the property rights provisions and how they are very good. We deserve judgment on that. there's some real potential, we believe, for environmental groups to intervene in these decisions. There's a provision in there where landowners can apply for a use and have to have a determination, originally 90 days and now it's 180 days and even now a year, up to a year. So we're very concerned that's another door for environmentalists to try and intervene in these cases. And a lot of our ESA law has occurred because environmental groups have sued the federal agencies because they haven't listed the species or gone through the proper paperwork and have forced these cases into courts that they're choosing before judges that they know are going to rule in their favor. And they won a whole host of great lawsuits that way, and it has built some very bad law for us. And that is, I think, a major concern in Pombo's bill. It's something that, if it is picked up in the Senate, needs to be considered if that's something that people are going to look seriously at. But third-party intervention, I think, is very scary.
Now, we have Catherine Lehman from Oregon. Catherine?
Hi.
Hello. brought you on the line later than I had hoped or anticipated. But Catherine is with the People for the USA, and tell us a bit your take on the Endangered Species Act and its proposed reauthorization under Chairman Pombo's bill.
Well, Michael, I agree completely with Margaret and Julie. I think the only rational option is to repeal this bill. It has many, many very dangerous provisions. It is completely 180 degrees, excuse me, I'm not putting my sentence together right, but if you've read Rick Frost's report, for instance, the way the ESA is being implemented is 180 degrees from what was designed originally from the text of the original act and its authorizing international treaties and agreements.
Well, there we go again. It's always coming back to the globalist plan, which calls first and foremost for the elimination of private property. So when you begin to tie the links together, there's a very coherent and consistent arrangement. And as Margaret just points out, they've got endangered species identified within every county, 3,300 mm-hmm. counties across the United States, and every one of them has endangered species, allowing the government to come in and start squeezing the landowners down.
When the Constitution was written, it specifically restricted the treaty-making powers of the Senate to strictly international dealings. And, you know, Congress had never intended, nor did the founders, to have the individual state sovereignties violated like this. The way it's being implemented, the Endangered Species Act, based on these international treaties and agreements, basically gives foreign countries the ability to dictate state affairs, you know, over their own resident wildlife and their own property. And the founders would never have put up with that.
Well, and
it wasn't the Constitution they wrote.
And beyond foreign countries, it has to do with international organizations and the backers of those international organizations, which ironically, for people who support the environmental movement, is really a consolidation of multinational corporations. So the international community is multinational corporations, and the ESA and bills like them come out of those organizations and
mm-hmm.
are sacrificing the lives and prospects of individual citizens across the United States. And it's all of us living in the urban areas that rely on the work product of the rural landowners for our own livelihoods. And when that gets squeezed down and we're put under this this Wildlands Project protocol coordinated and ordained by internationalists, we're all going to pay a heavy price, very heavy price. Give us an example that are familiar with in respect to how it is the Endangered Species Act's application has destroyed communities. You're up there in the Northwest, and that must be a relatively easy thing to find, I suppose.
It is, and that's how our organization and the parent organization, predecessor organizations before us, got founded, was in response to the attack on the logging industry, specifically when the environmentalists went after all of the quote-unquote old-growth forests in the Pacific Northwest. And unfortunately, their activities and court case successes and what have you have devastated not only the logging industry in the Pacific Northwest and even some of the south central states or southwestern states like Arizona and New Mexico, and from the logging industry they've gone off to attack the farming and ranching communities. Our organization has been active in the Klamath Basin situation since it started up, trying to help educate them on what was going on, that they were not alone, that this wasn't an isolated incident, that they weren't sitting on some truly unique, very endangered species, and, you know, that there's a plan, there's an agenda with a capital A, and what have you. And we also are involved with people that are being attacked because of their mining operations. this whole thing is working to shut down the productive ability, the extractive and resource-producing industries of our nation, the wealth-producing foundations of our nation.
Well, and as those go, so will manufacturing jobs and circumstances and productivity and jobs across the country, urban as well as rural. So it's crucial that people begin to take recognition of the massive effects and the cascading effects of the Endangered Species Act and its 30 years of application. And, of course, a reauthorization, Margaret, means what? It means another 30 years?
Well, that's the way I read the bill, and I know Kathy's gone through the bill pretty carefully, and I'm sure Julie has too. Kathy, by the way, is one of the individuals that we were really fortunate to work with through this whole thing. And she's been a great resource to us. But I don't see a limitation or a sunset in it, which means that it would go back to the sunset of the original law. So that would be 30 years. But I know I've seen in other reports that it's supposed to only reauthorize till 2010. So I'm not quite sure where that's coming from. I might be missing something on that.
Do you have any input on that, Kathy?
I was going to say, I remember that's what the resource staffers told us, and I remember seeing it in an early version. I think it was the one in June and July that we were able to stop before that was so horrid. I have not finished pouring back over Tessera, now that it has passed the House and has grown by an extra 15 pages over. Been very carefully reviewing it, and I haven't seen a specific, sunset provision or anything like that in it yet. Doesn't mean it's not there. I just haven't found it.
Well, the best sunset provision would be a provision that repealed the law or let it die a natural death. It does, my sense certainly is that people are beginning to understand that putting these 1,300 species at the top of the block when it comes to how this country is to manage and govern itself is a mistake in so many ways, and becoming increasingly a costly mistake at a time when America can't afford those kinds of errors. I believe that a call for repeal is going to begin to build, and it will become resounding over some period of time. And so it strikes me that if we just let this bill continue to rot, which is what I think it's doing, all of America will be in improved condition come just a couple years from now.
It certainly would. I'm very concerned that they're going to try to fast-track this through the Senate before we have enough time to educate enough people. The Senate is less responsive to the general population in the country. They tend to be more green. I'm very concerned that they may just, shove something through before we have a chance to really build up enough resistance to get it stopped. There was a fair amount of money spent on the campaign to get this thing through the House, and I think if that had been spent with the general population getting this subject out into the light of day, we'd all be better off.
Well, I understand that. I want to thank both of you ladies for being on the show tonight and for all the work you've done on this issue and the other issues of freedom. This hour has just flown by, and I'll look forward to talking with you both in the future.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Good night. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, coming right up.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to the second hour of tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and we're going to pick up on a very similar theme to the last hour's show. This hour we're going to talk about conservation easements, and while for some that may sound like a bizarre combination of words, we're going to explain what it means and show how it, too, works to implement the globalist wildlands project for the United States. That is taking people and activity and even recreation use off of over 50% of the landscape of the American lands. Tonight, our guest to discuss conservation easements is Dan Byfield. Dan is with the American Land Foundation in Texas and is editor of Liberty Matters. Now, if those sound a little familiar from the last hour, it is the case that Dan Byfield is the husband of Margaret Byfield, who was our guest in the last hour. The use of conservation easements has exploded across the American landscape, and we're going to learn how this tool has been used to further the aims of those who are working to advance the Wildlands Project in America and thereby further global governance objectives. So we're going to discuss the truth that sits behind conservation easements and how some landowners are beginning to understand the negative impact of accepting or engaging in conservation easement planning with land trusts or government agencies. Dan, are you with us?
I sure am.
Well, so it's good to hear from you. And I'm excited to end up understanding more about conservation easements as this hour proceeds. Before we have to go to a quick break here, give us a synopsis about what this show is going to be about.
Well, what I really would like for everyone to understand is one of the arguments that is always used against what we talk about on conservation easements is that these are totally voluntary agreements. And yes, that's true, but what most people don't understand is all the rights that they give up and the fact that it's in perpetuity, it's forever. You basically are giving away your children's inheritance, and once people realize what the true nature of these agreements are, most people say no thanks, and that's what we want them to understand is these are not as great as the proponents actually are saying of them.
Well, you can put whipped cream on poison, but it's still poison.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. You know, and when you talk about it being voluntary, yeah, that's true. You know, the landowner has to put his signature to a document, but it reminds me of being in the schoolyard and having your arm cranked up behind your back higher and higher until you say uncle. Well, you voluntarily say uncle.
Right.
Much the way some landowners subject to regulatory pressures end up putting their signature on the dotted line.
Very true. The whole point also being is that there are so many, what people don't understand when they sign one of these agreements is they create a split estate, and I want to get into that. I want to talk about how that you create a subservient estate and a dominant estate, and who's who.
Well, that's a real important question, because understanding the nature of property law is key if you're going to own property, and understanding what you just brought up is crucial. We'll be right back at Freedom 21. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. While some of our station affiliates take a break for commercials, we're going to continue our discussion with our special guest, Dan Byfield of the American Land Foundation. Well, Dan, let's continue about that split estate. Explain for our listeners what you mean by a split estate.
You know, what happens is when you sign one of these agreements, you literally are granting specific rights to another party, and you are the grantor, they are the grantee, and in real property law, you have what's called a fee simple estate. And when you sign one of these agreements, you are in essence conveying part of that estate or multiple parts of that estate to another party. And if you don't understand what you're doing, you're in big trouble. And what you in essence do is you give all management control aspects to another party. And there's multiple kinds of agreements here, but there's basically two that we always talk about. One is the basic conservation easement, and the other is a purchase of development rights, and they call them, in short, PDRs. But they're both the same basic document, but a PDR is where you sell your right to develop your land, any future development of your land, to another party. That's one of the greatest values you have in your real property, that you in this document convey to another party to hold in perpetuity on your behalf. And they pay you for that, but it's at a reduced rate and everything else. And so
it would be as though I came to the listener and I said, look, I'll give you $50 and you can continue to own your car, but I'll be the guy who determines who can drive it, when they can drive it, and where they can drive it to. Now, we may have title ownership to that car and continue to pay your car tax,
right. But
if you don't have the right to determine the management of an asset, then you can hardly be said to have the beneficial use of enjoyment.
Exactly right. And the whole point of what these conservation easements do is they restrict the use or take away a use which reduces the value, which is where you get the tax benefit out of these documents. But what that also does is it lowers the value of the land to where when they make the offer to the landowner to put this land in one of these conservation easements, they can pay you less.
Now hold that thought for just a moment, Dan. We're going to welcome our audience back.
Sure.
Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. We're here tonight with our guest Dan Byfield discussing conservation easements and how it really strips away the value for landowners who sign these conservation easements with either land trusts or the government. It strips away the value of their property because the conservation easement either transfers the future use, the development rights of the property away from them, or actually strips away the management decisions from the landowner, the farmer, or the rancher, and leaves him with, not what he had before, and oftentimes not very much at all. And let's continue with the discussion, Dan.
Sure. I think what we need to do, Michael, is back up a little bit, and a lot of people probably know what conservation easements are, but they are, as you said at the beginning of your program, a tool that is being used, widely used now, by government entities and land trusts, non-governmental organizations. And these were created probably 20 years ago, very quietly, and most people never even heard of a conservation easement until maybe a year or two ago. And now they are the tool du jour, if you will, by federal agencies wanting to tie up land in as inexpensive way as they possibly can. Instead of going out and condemning your land and paying you fair market value, these are actually ways that government entities and land trusts are going out and grabbing land at lower costs and taking away rights of the actual landowner. So people really need to understand it isn't something that just happened overnight. These have been in the works for a long, long time, and they are now just coming up with all the mechanisms to entice landowners to place conservation easements on their land one way or another. And it's either a general enticement or it is a very heavy regulatory type inducement that forces a landowner into a corner, and the only option that is offered to them at this point are conservation easements.
The only way out of a deep hole, for instance, I suppose, if Farmer Jones dies and the tax authorities show up and want huge inheritance taxes, you might have somebody from the land trust show up with some cash and a conservation easement. Is that a kind
right,
of circumstance?
That is one of the insidious ways that a land trust uses a conservation easement. When they go to the widow, whose husband's been dead for 10 years, and she doesn't know what to do with the estate, and as you always hear, you're land rich and cash poor, and when you have somebody coming to your door and saying, we're the good guys and we can help you, it sounds very, very enticing. And in fact, Michael, it has helped a lot of people in certain situations. In that very instance, exactly, but what she will be doing, like I said earlier, is giving away the inheritance and giving away basically the greatest value the land may have in the future. It may not be cattle grazing in the future. It may actually be condominiums. It may be a golf course. It may be something that in the future the children, grandchildren would love to have been able to develop. But for the conservation easement, which is in perpetuity, they can never change that.
Well, and of course, people in the community think, well, we're getting open space when the land trust comes in and takes ownership. But in fact, what they're getting is a cage around their community where people have to continue to jam in closer and closer together. So this is all really part and parcel of the smart growth movement as well as the Wildlands Project.
That's exactly what it is. And you were right earlier about the Wildlands, and I assume your audience knows about that scheme or that plan, but it is literally a way that they are going, that environmentalists and the people with this agenda have decided they're going to maneuver everybody into spaces where they can only live, and every place else, 50% of the rest of the country has to be nature corridors and preserves with no human habitation. And people used to laugh at me when I'd talk about these things, but it literally is happening.
Well, it's literally happening, and we're certainly finding out that people don't brush it off like they used to.
Right.
Because the evidence is everywhere, and more of us understand what's really going on, and it's just impossible for the for those who would like to discount this reality to do so any longer.
Well, I'll tell you the other thing. I was doing some research. We have a newsletter, which you mentioned, called Liberty Matters, and every week we go out with information about what's going on around the country or in Washington, and I did a search on conservation easements, and it was phenomenal to me, the money. Gail Norton announced a $70 million grant project just last month, where she's going to give money to, I think, 18 different states for this very specific purpose, to go out and place conservation easements on land all over the country. And they literally are just throwing millions and millions and millions of dollars to purchase and take away the rights of landowners in this country. And what they're doing is destroying our liberty. They're destroying the individual's ability to own their private property, and they're transferring it literally over to another party. And so many people just, they think of their own situation, and they don't realize there's a big picture going on here. And once you start filling in the pieces of the puzzle, it's huge, absolutely huge.
Well, the damage this can cause to communities, rural communities particularly, and to the individuals, of course, begins to be rooted by the consequences, the adverse consequences it causes to all of America. And I think people are beginning to understand that that the theft of rural lands by government and its partners, and that's what they've become, is the partners, the NGO partners, the land trust partners, etc., is really a theft of the future of America and a theft against all Americans, not just the rancher or the farmer or the timberland owner who's had his property his property's use squeezed down or actually taken. And that's what more and more people need to come to understand so that we can bring an end to this stuff.
That's right. Well, conservation easements are, I think, very insidious, and they're even showing up, and they showed up in the last farm bill that Congress passed, and they are now going to become very much more prominent in the next farm bill, I've heard and I've read and I've been told. So this Congress is actually, I think, increasing the use. You know, years ago, those of us in the property rights movement said, by golly, if you want my land, you need to pay me for it. You know, that's what the Fifth Amendment says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And so somebody somewhere down the road figured out a very clever scheme in a conservation easement. And even friends of mine now in agriculture say, you know, Dan, you're wrong on this. This is the solution to what we've all been saying for years. But instead of us having to leave our land and be bought out and the government take over, we get to stay on our land. And we've reduced our taxes. And we've got a big payment, a front payment. And what better... You know, what better situation can you have, Dan? You know, but then you start explaining to the people what they have to give away, literally give up forever, and then they begin to think, well, that's not such a great idea. Yeah, that one-time payment sounds very enticing and very luring, and the tax incentives and the tax abatements and all of that are something my family needs. But I don't want to give away my management, the control of my land. I don't want to turn it over to a third party who can come on my property anytime they want, tell me what I have to do, and then make me pay for it.
Give us some examples of how that management dynamic is affected.
Okay. Well, is it affected or what they can do, you mean?
Yeah, what happens to the typical landowner?
So, let me just go down. The other day, I took a Nature Conservancy conservation easement form, the basic form that they are applying around a fort in Texas, and I took it and read it, and I did a synopsis of it, and it wasn't even my analysis of it. I just literally took it and went verbatim and wrote it a three-page synopsis, and this is a great document. If anybody in your audience wants it, I can email it or mail it to them. But one of the first things that it says is you can't subdivide your land, and that's where you give away your development rights. So your children won't be able literally to, you can't subdivide it for your children even, so they can build a home on it. There can be no construction of structures or improvements except those that are negotiated at the time of the signing of it. You can repair and maintain things, but it's closely monitored. Mineral extraction is not allowed, or it's limited or not allowed at all. Grazing is allowed only on existing fields. If you're in a set-aside type program, you can write in there that that's an existing use, but you can't open up a new field. If it isn't being grazed when you sign this, it can never be used for grazing in the future. You can't harvest your timber. This all comes out of the Nature Conservancy form, and I'm just going down it. They require buffer areas along rivers and creeks where there's no grazing at all allowed along your own creek.
So you got to put a fence up around?
Yeah, you got to put a fence up,
mm-hmm.
And then they come out periodically to ensure the soil stability and water quality and other conservation values are protected. They literally come out and they make sure that, you know, there's no runoff into the creeks or anything from your cattle. And if there is, they can make you move the cattle even further back away from the creek. There's no hunting allowed. Hunting is allowed, but no form of motorized transportation can be used. I'll skip through some of these. Here was one that was just, I couldn't believe it. It says, no use of fertilizers, plowing, introduction of non-native animals, or disturbance or change of the natural habitat in any manner.
Non-native animals or plants?
Non-native animals.
Well, that would include a cow, wouldn't it?
Possibly. You can't, you can use whatever wells you have in existence at the time, but they won't allow you to drill any new wells.
So when your well expires, you can't replace it.
That's exactly right.
Well, you've got some sort of limited life.
That's right.
No well lasts forever.
There's no dams, no impoundment structures allowed, no pesticides, biocides, insecticides, fungicides, rodenticides, or herbicides can be used, except as approved.
And this would apply to farms as well as ranches?
Yes, yes. Any open space, you have to, under the IRS code, you can only apply a conservation easement for four purposes, and, you know, it's... They're all spelled out and specified, but it basically it's public outdoor recreation, education, protection of habitats or ecosystems, preservation of historically important land areas, or preservation of open space that will clearly yield a public benefit. Those are the four purposes that a conservation easement is supposed to apply to the land, and once one of those four criteria is met, then the IRS and it's in perpetuity, then the IRS will grant the benefits under the IRS code, which is where you get your tax benefits from. But that's also the requirements of a conservation easement that are written into the IRS code itself. So you have to meet one of those four criteria, and then once the conservation easement gets applied for open space, say, like it's a farm and it's near a city and they don't want development there, well, they go out and say, well, we want this for open space and we don't want it developed. Well, that's one of the criteria for a conservation easement. Therefore, we have the authority through the IRS code to place a conservation easement on this property. And so they get the landowner to sign the agreement in perpetuity, and he gets his payment and his tax abatement, and it's locked up forever.
And I would argue, in that circumstance, everybody loses, except for those who are seeking to put the American resources under the thumb of the coordinated public-private partnership of the globalists.
That's exactly right. But the county loses because that land is no longer taxable because it's basically owned by a nonprofit organization or a government entity. The landowner, he still pays some sort of taxes on it. I suppose he does pay taxes, but it's on a reduced rate. If the non-government organization or the government entity decides to come back and purchase it in fee simple and buy the whole thing, this is another insidious part about this, Michael, is that what I've been told happens in an easement, say a land trust comes and you sell them a conservation easement and you sold all these rights to them, if they come back and purchase the easement in fee title or the land in fee title from you, that easement goes away.
Yeah.
And I said this to a lot of people. I think part of the insidious part of this is that land trusts are not stupid. They are wealthy individuals who are lawyers. They are investors. They are accountants. They're political gurus that know how the system works. And I think part of what conservation easements are in this country is actually transformation of ownership, transferring ownership from one party to another, That's what history is all about anyway. Who owns the land?
Sure. And that's, you know, what we always say on this show, that the wonder of the American experience is that this is the first country in the history of the world and the only one today that has a history and was predicated on the idea that the citizens would own the lands and the natural resources of this country, and then the citizens are the ones who bring the benefits of those resources to the other citizens. And so those people working hard out in the rural areas to extract from nature those resources that make all of our lives so good are the ones we've depended on. And once this just turns over to the same crowd that controls the rest of the world, America's shining light will dim and finally blow out, and all of humanity will pay a price for that.
I agree, and I think that all of our crops and goods that our farmers raise today for human consumption and for livestock consumption will all be pushed, you know, out into other countries, and we'll be importing it. And it's very sad. I totally agree with what you're saying, that it's there is, and I have said this, I think there is an actual transfer of ownership going on in this country, and it's mainly through conservation easements. That it's so very silent and very quietly happening, and I think this administration is actually perpetuating it and speeding it up, and I hate to even say that, but it is actually happening.
Well, it certainly is happening, and again, we talked about it in the last hour, the Taking Liberty video, coordinated by Stewards of the Range and Dr. Michael Kaufman, does a beautiful job of illustrating that reality. State by state.
Well, my foundation did that as well. It was American Land Foundation and Stewards of the Range, and then we hired Michael to put that together. So, yeah, no, it's a terrific tool to explain to people what's going on in this country.
Tell us a little bit about the American Land Foundation.
We are an organization that was created back in the mid-90s by the Federal Land Bank. And if you don't know who they are, they're not a federal agency. They are a co-op that loans money to farmers and ranchers. And when I went to work for them, I was working these environmental issues, and I got them to help me create this foundation. And when I left the bank back in 1994, I guess it was, they let me take the foundation, and they've actually funded me for a long time and helped me get this up and going. And so we have been helping landowners for nearly 15 years now, and 11, 12 years, but I've been in this business 15 to 20 years, and we do litigation. We just had a lawsuit that we took all the way to the Supreme Court, where we were challenging the constitutionality of the take provision of the Endangered Species Act, and created some great precedent along the way out of the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, and got to the Supreme Court, sat there for a year, and they just denied us without giving us any reason. And it was 1 week before the Kelo decision. And it was a very bad summer.
It was a very bad summer at the Supreme Court. Now, that case, which has some interesting facts that we might describe here briefly, really fell down when the Santa Cruz medical marijuana case was decided.
In fact, that case was decided the week before they denied our case, and we realized way before that case got argued, and it was a Commerce Clause case similar to ours. The facts obviously weren't the same, but it was a Commerce Clause case where they were challenging the federal authority. Do we need to go to a break?
We've got another 40 seconds or so.
Okay. Well, we were challenging the congressional authority to regulate through a federal law. Now, we were challenging the federal authority of the Endangered Species Act, and our plaintiff had six bugs that lived in holes on his property. that for 17 years U.S. Fish and Wildlife has denied his use of that land because he has these cave bugs on his property and they're supposedly endangered, and they will not give him a permit. So we
all justified under application of the Commerce Commerce Clause. How else does the federal government get in and regulate a state's bugs? We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guest, Dan Byfield. We're back here at our Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our guest Dan Byfield. While some stations take a commercial break, we'll continue our discussion with Dan. So when the Supreme Court decided that the federal government was not precluded from regulating medical marijuana here in Santa Cruz and in California generally, that had a dramatic effect on your cave bug case in Texas.
Yeah, as Justice Thomas said in his dissent of your marijuana case, he said, if you can regulate this, you can regulate anything. And I think at that moment, they realized, the Supreme Court justices, that they did not have, since that was a 5-4 ruling in the marijuana case, they didn't have the votes to even take our case up and hear it. So they just denied us, but we had some great justices at the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans give us a great opinion that agreed with us, saying that Congress, you know, they create all these laws under the Commerce Clause, and it's a catch-all clause. It's become a catch-all clause over the last 50 years since the Roosevelt era that the courts have just literally granted almost a blank check authority to Congress to create any law they want, and we decided we would challenge that, and when they denied us, they basically said cave bugs have more rights than human beings on their own private property.
And they also said that we, the federal government, can do anything we want. There's no limitation, whether it's imposed by Article 2, Section 8, or the Tenth Amendment. There simply is no limitation to what the federal government can do. And we see that with the application of the Endangered Species Act, with the setting aside of state rules here, there, and everywhere. And it doesn't matter if you're left or right. We're all going to pay a price for a constitutional system that is falling apart. It's certainly a sad circumstance. do you find that it is the Nature Conservancy that's in the middle of these conservation easements as often as not?
As often as not, yes. But well, believe it or not, there are, in Texas, where I am right now, there are over 1,200 land trusts registered in the state of Texas to do business just in Texas alone.
Wow.
And that's just this one state. You know, there are literally tens of thousands of these land trusts that have just popped up. They're funded. I mean, almost every family trust, you know, you can go back to the Mellons and the Rockefellers, and I mean, there's just big money that has just always funded these causes. The Nature Conservancy is probably, well, they are, I would say, the largest land trust at this point. There's American Farmland Trust, there's several other well-known land trusts, but Nature Conservancy is really the one that kind of started the ball rolling on all of this. And in fact, Michael, I don't know if you know this, but in Texas, we had someone found in our state tax code an exemption that specifically named the Nature Conservancy as being exempted from property tax in counties where they own land. There's a nonprofit wherever they purchase land in a county. They had an exemption from paying taxes up to a certain amount of acreage that they would own in each county. Well, we found that, and it was something that just got on the books, you know, maybe 12, 13 years ago, very quietly. Nobody knew what in the world that was about. And the fact that they are specifically named in the tax code as giving them a specific exemption we thought was unconstitutional. You know, you can't just willy-nilly go out and say John Doe is exempted from taxes and write it into the tax code. It's just unconstitutional.
He's the largest landowner, I think, in the world.
That's right.
And certainly what we're moving toward, you know, when we add up all these pieces, is toward a global corporate socialist state.
Right.
And I don't know anybody, you know, left or right, who'd be happy with the idea of living in a global corporate socialist state. And the Nature Conservancy is a huge player in that. In fact, we've done shows on the Nature Conservancy and have had them described as the most insidiously rotten organization in all of America.
Well, they, you know, fortunately they're being investigated by Congress, which I don't, you and I know, is not going to go anywhere, but the fact that they have gotten a black eye over it is a good thing. I mean, we all cheered when that happened, but I don't see anything that's going to result of that. I hope something does, but they'll just probably get slapped on the hand, and they'll just continue doing what they're doing because they are so infiltrated into our government. I'll give you an example. I'm fighting an issue right now on an army base called Fort Hood, which is north of me by about 60 miles. It's right in the middle of the state of Texas. It is where the infantry that captured Saddam Hussein is from Fort Hood. That's who these guys are. These are the greatest trained military men that we've got in the nation. And they have an endangered species issue on every base does. I mean, this is how insidious this is, but the Nature Conservancy is involved in that issue. And they have an agreement with the Army on a national scale, national basis, to create buffer zones around Army bases and naval bases and in the entire country. The Nature Conservancy has an agreement with them. It is a memorandum of understanding with the Nature Conservancy and the Department of Defense to create buffer zones around bases around our nation. That's how tied in these people are to just our government, and they show up everywhere.
Well, they're lawyers and real estate brokers. They're not
nature
experts. No.
No. And that was my point earlier, that whenever conservation easement in particular, I really believe that these guys are so powerful, so smart, and so wealthy that someday they literally will own all of this land outright, and they are then going to be the ones who can develop it and who can make money off of it. And you know, that's how far-reaching I believe this truly is.
But when that happens, and I do think with you that is the plan, when that happens, we'll be living in a feudal society.
Yeah, we will all be serfs. As Jim Burling says, it'll be a serfship that we live in, and we'll be the peasants.
Well, it's not something anybody I know that looks forward to.
Well, Michael, that's why we are now, and this is a tremendous educational process we're all going through. My foundation, several years ago, I started really seeing what conservation easements were doing and where I thought they were heading, and so we started educating people about them, and there are people are now learning what these are. I've been told this Fort Hood issue I was just telling you about. I got a call from a very high-ranking official in the state of Texas, and she's an elected statewide official, and she called me and said, "Ben, listen, we're not going to use conservation easements around that fort." And I said, "Well, that's interesting. I don't know, what are you going to use?" "Well, we're going to go to leases." I mean, they literally have stump their toes because people are catching on to what is happening, and so they're literally, as we speak, are coming up with another version of the easement, and they're going to call it a lease. It's going to be a 30-year term, but you and I know, Michael, that this lease won't be a lease like you and I have ever seen before. It will have very similar language as a conservation easement. And 30 years down the road, you and I will probably be gone from this earth, and it'll, so they're never going to remove that management and that hold they will have on the land, and they know that in 30 years everything will change, and they will never release their hold on that property.
Well, sure. I mean, once they get their foot in the door, they can play with the legislation and regulation, and they can create management practices that step by step make it tougher and tougher for a landowner to be able to survive until finally he just, after 20 years, with 10 years to go, is begging to get out of ownership of the property.
Right.
And,
one thing I wanted to explain to people about a conservation easement, there are several aspects of this. The one thing, if anybody is considering this, there is a phrase that is in every single conservation easement, and it's just basically called the catch-all phrase, and it basically says that you cannot alter or modify the management plan of this easement that's placed on this land, and they have, it says any method's not consistent with the terms of this easement. So in other words, you can't make any changes that are not consistent with the management plan of the easement. If you do, then you're in default of the easement, and they can actually come out and force you to do whatever it is they say that you have to do. So 5 years from now, they may decide that the management plan and the management aspects of that property need to change. You may be running cattle on it, but they may decide that no, cattle are not consistent with the management of this land anymore. And in 5 years, they can come out and they can tell you, you have to remove your cattle. And there is nothing you can do about it. You have to abide by what they demand, or they can literally go to court, get an injunction against you, and have your cattle removed.
My.
And that is the one phrase that if you don't realize that's in there, you have just swallowed their hook all the way down to your stomach. There is a great case out of the Ninth Circuit. Aren't you in the Ninth Circuit out there?
Yes, we are.
Have you ever heard of Big Meadows Grazing Association versus United States?
I think I've only read about that in Stewards of the Range.
Okay, well, in 2003, 2 years ago, there was a case that came up from your district, federal district court, went to the Ninth Circuit, and it was a grazing association that decided they were going to do a conservation easement on their allotment, on their land, and on their private land, and to maintain a wetland, and they were going to get paid to put this into a conservation easement, and the management plan was drafted, and they signed the agreement, and in the agreement they were to
The landowner.
Huh?
The landowner, you mean?
Yeah, I'm sorry, the landowner. Well, there were several landowners that signed this agreement, and they were to spend $80,000. They were told in the easement that they were going to have to spend $80,000 to manage this land properly under the easement. And they all agreed to that because they were going to get $1.9 million or something like that for the easement up front. So they were all going to get a great big payment up front to put this into an easement. And so, and the $80,000 was just going to be what they figured was their expense, annual expense, and they was going to be divided amongst eight or nine of them, so they thought, well, this isn't so bad. Well, believe it or not, literally before the ink dried on it, they came back, government came back and said, wait a minute, it's now going to cost you $486,000, six times the original amount you agreed to maintain this easement. And instead of just restoring a stream bed or something, we're going to require you to build a dam to impound water on the acreage because it was a wetland, so they apparently decided that they wanted to create a bigger wetland. And so these,
or actually get the wetland to become wet once in a while.
to actually be a wetland.
Yeah.
So the landowner said, there's no way. We didn't agree to that, so they filed a suit to have the conservation easement denied or annulled or whatever the term would be, and the court said no, you signed this agreement, you you gave all those rights over to the government. They now have the full authority to manage your land, and you have no ability to ever alter that, change it. You must always comply with what the government tells you you must do.
So it really is a master-slave relationship if you sign these agreements, and you know, and all burdens are paid for by the landowner.
Right.
And I think
exactly
that case illustrates it perfectly. We have a call from Lee in Brookings, Oregon. Lee, are you with us? Hello, Lee?
Hi.
Hi. You have a question or a comment for our guest?
I have some comments. And I'd like to say hello to Julie and Kathy, because I know them both.
Okay.
And they're doing a great job. Everybody there is doing a great job.
Well, that was our last hour on the Endangered Species Act.
Yes. And, you know, with the chemtrails and the Wildlands Project combined to basically nuke the American mind, so that no one can even imagine what's being done to them. I think you're doing a wonderful job there. And, you know, we're supposed to pick a side, you know, pick a D or an R, and put a badge on and fight for that. And, you know, let's fight the D's or fight the R's, right? Meanwhile, they're doing what they're going to do. And
well, there certainly seems to be a coordinated plan between the left and the right. Do you have a question for Dan in the context of conservation easements or an observation?
No, I've read up on conservation easements. Thank you, Julie, and Kathy, and Larry, and a number of other people. So I'm well aware of the damage that they do, and what they want to do. I guess my question is, if I need to have a question. Is the American people who are concerned and are aware, and God knows there's more of them than you can even conceive of.
More every day.
They want to do something, okay? They're sick of sitting around whining about it, okay? And they see their country, I mean, their National Guard's over protecting Syria's border, for Christ's sake.
So your question?
And my question is, and this is the question that was asked of me today again. What do we do about it as Americans?
What thoughts do you have, Dan?
Let me tell you exactly what we are doing, and I'll go back to my Fort Hood. And this is, we're talking about this in my foundation of going nationwide with this program or project, whatever you want to call it. There are a group of landowners that have called me around the base that said, you know, can you explain to us, first of all, they didn't know what a conservation easement was, so I explained it to them. Well, they all said, well, there's no way in God's green earth I'm ever going to do that. And they said, but Dan, there's a bigger problem here. There are 240,000 acres of land that the Army wants around this base, and probably 1,000 landowners that don't have any clue that the Army wants to do this. So we have announced a meeting. They formed a landowner group called Our Land, Our Lives. And I'll tell you what we're doing. We are literally individual citizens banding together, standing up, and saying not only no, but we're saying hell no. We are drawing the proverbial line in the sand, and we are going to tell the Department of Defense, the Army, by God, we support you, we love you, we love the fact that your men are over there defending our liberty and our, you know, protecting our freedoms, but you don't need any more of our private property. And this issue belongs on your fort. It is your problem, not ours. And these guys, I'm telling you, they have taken a strong stand, and they have awakened everybody. The congressman is now aware of what's going on. Our state officials are aware of what's going on. And it has changed the entire game plan that they had for all of those landowners around that fort, because they've all awakened and they all know now what's happening and what's going to happen to them if they don't just say no. And what are they going to do? Are they going to come out and condemn everybody's land and take them off their property?
Well, that is what landowners need to do. They need to organize at the local level and combine with other communities later on. You really cannot wait, in my opinion, let me know what you think, you cannot wait for the Farm Bureau or the Cattlemen's Association, some of these long-standing national and international organizations to come and do your bidding for you. They're just not consistently doing that.
Let me, you shouldn't have said that because... Let me tell you, the Farm Bureau is in support of these things, and they are out there helping the Environmental Defense, the Nature Conservancy, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. They have formed a Central Texas Sustainability Coalition, which is nothing but a group of independent organizations, individuals, and environmental groups that are literally have formed a group to put a plan together under the Endangered Species Act that is going to require private landowners to comply. And that irritates me to no end when groups like the Farm Bureau are out there saying, you know, we're the voice of agriculture. Well, by God, they don't speak for me, and they don't speak for the thousands of other landowners that disagree with them. And it's all tied into politics. It's all tied into what they think is the wave of the future and the direction this country's going. And that is baloney.
Well, the American Farm Bureau is an accredited by the United Nations NGO, non-governmental organization, and to do that, you've got to be committed to the Sustainable Development Agenda 21 program.
Right.
And here in Santa Cruz, our farmers, despite California law, have been subjected to massive taxes on pumping of their own water through their wells. And the Farm Bureau is just silent as silent could be.
Right, and that's why I agree with what you said earlier. It's the individuals. It literally is the individual person standing up finally and just saying no, and that's what these guys are doing, and I love it. I mean, they're strong Americans that have given me hope where I had almost lost it all before, and I really want, they're doing these buffer zones, and Fort Bragg apparently has already succumbed to it, and there's four or five others, Arizona and, I don't know, some other western states that have bases where they've been doing these things. Well, what we need to do is start educating more people. All you've got to do is just say no and stand up to these folks, and it will turn the issue around. It will have to.
And it'll be glorious when that happens. Speaking of just saying no, we have Daniel from Corralitos, California, one of those fellows who has stood up in his neighborhood and just said no. This has to do with a sustainable community plan for his town called Corralitos. Daniel, are you with us?
I'm here.
Well, what's your question or comment?
Yeah, I just had a question for Dan regarding the recent partnership between the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Nature Conservancy. I'm wondering what Dan thinks about that.
Well, it's just as insidious as all of the other arrangements with the federal agency. NCIS, let me step back. NCIS has actually always been a very good partner with landowners. They've done great work in the past. Let me tell you, they are just like any other agency, federal agency. They are being dragged in to this whole concept, and you know, President Bush has even signed an executive order of what do they call it, cooperative conservation.
Yes.
So all of these agencies, including NRCS now, are all supposed to be working towards the same stated goal of getting landowners to cooperatively agree, which that's just a buzzword for figuring out various ways of controlling private property, whether they pay the landowner, whether they sign it up under some program or whatever. And NRCS is unfortunately, I think, going to be used in a way where most landowners trust them and listen to them. They're going to be used in a way where down the road, landowners are going to be very disappointed.
I know they're big on conservation easements in our NRCS.
Right.
They are. Real hard.
Well, they have been ordered to be very proactive in conservation easements. But I tell you, it's, Daniel, the good thing is that people are beginning to wake up. Unfortunately, there are hundreds, maybe, you know, literally thousands of people that have already done this. And you know, I hate to say it, they made mistakes, but they all did it voluntarily. They all did it for whatever reason they did it. But from now on, I guarantee you that people are waking up to this, and it's going to be a much harder sell in the future. They may trust their local NRCS office right now, but, you know, in 10, 15 years from now, when their son is trying to run their farm and they're dealing with a different individual that probably came from the Nature Conservancy is now in that office, it's going to be a different world.
I'm sitting here with a cooperator agreement, the terms of assistance and notification to be executed between a landowner and the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Santa Cruz County Resource Conservation District. I tell you, I was on the Santa Cruz County Resource Conservation District in the 90s, and back then we ran with a few dollars. Everything was volunteer, and the idea was that if there were issues, land management issues, we'd circulate the information to landowners and work with the NRCS, who would then work with landowners on a cooperative basis. It all seemed to make some sense, but now they're funded with $10 million and more per year, and it's all in the form of grant monies and these little special arrangements. And now they've come out with these cooperator agreements, and I'll tell you, if you don't sign the cooperator agreement, you're going to have trouble with the agencies. If you do sign the cooperator agreement, you're in big trouble as a landowner, because you've just given up your, you know, you've just become the slave to a master.
Well, and that's the unfortunate aspect of farming in this country with the farm subsidy programs. I have always been opposed to those programs, but, you know, being in agriculture, you kind of tiptoe around that, because so many people, you have to be in one of those programs if you're going to be able to survive as a farmer or, you know, in this country. And
well, and that's only because everybody else has been made dependent, and the market has been screwed by it, and so, you know, one sins and everybody else has to sin just to stay in the race.
Right.
I think part of it, too, I mean, with NRCS locally, it's kind of, they're kind of playing the good cop thing.
Yeah.
Good cop, bad cop. They're out here to save you, and I think a lot of, some people are falling for that.
Well, they are, Daniel, and that's a real unfortunate aspect of this, because, and you know, you've got the other aspect, too, where people just don't like, most real people don't talk bad about, or they respect the government still enough where they don't think that they're going to do something that'll harm them.
Yeah.
And that's the older generation. That's just where they've been raised and brought up. And, you know, but there's enough of us that are skeptical, that are realizing, you know, the farm bill has changed. And NRCS, it used to be the set-aside where you just had a rotable soil, you'd plant grasses, and you'd do it for 5-10 years, and that program went away. Well, now they're conservation easements. And you may sign it thinking it was the same set-aside program, and that's a very insidious part of what's going on right now with these programs, that people are not being told, I don't think, the full story. And that's what we're trying to do, is educate as many people as, you know, read that agreement, get good legal advice, good accounting advice, and then if you have to sign it, you know, try to put in as many protections as you can for yourself, but otherwise, try not to sign it.
Yep. I better get off. Thank you, guys.
Well, thank you, Daniel.
Yep.
Now, Dan, we got about less than a minute left. What is it you can leave our audience with, or is there a way someone can contact you should they find it appropriate?
Yeah, we've got our website, which is www.amland.org, and then 800-452-6389.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us tonight, and the combination of the Endangered Species Act and conservation easements is enough to rattle the boots of any landowner in this country, and the goal is to escape the application of the one and don't submit yourself to the rules of the other. And I want to thank our audience for being with us tonight, and we look forward to next week on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. Thank you again, Dan.
Thank you, Michael.